So here's the thing. I want to start off by saying that, you know, I'm trained as a physician. I've been teaching medicine my whole career. I study medicine. That's all I really do. Obviously, I have a general education like anyone else, and I'm an avid reader. But, you know, what I'm going to talk about tonight is really what I've learned in the past year. And I've largely learned that by discovering the limits of what I'm finding that the science behind ivermectin is reaching, which is the problem with ivermectin is not the science. It's not about small trials, poorly designed trials. It's about none of that. It's many people have everyone believe that it's a problem with the science, but it's not. And so I'm going to talk to you and your audience tonight about a topic which is really beyond the science. I am tired about talking about the data for ivermectin. In my opinion, it's proven. And so I'm going to very briefly give an overview of that data, and then I'm going to talk about what's happening with ivermectin in the world, outside of my ICU, outside of my practice. What's happening? Why isn't the science of ivermectin being recognized? And the couple of concepts I'm going to introduce tonight is this concept of big science, and I'll define it for you as I have lived it and interpreted it in my life in the past year. And then what I've recently become a student of, which is this topic of disinformation. Now, keeping in mind, misinformation is what I'm accused of. But there's actually another topic that's very well defined and has been for decades, which is called disinformation. And I'm going to talk about what the implications are for the patients around the globe. Okay, so here we go. And so what I'm going to want to do briefly before we get to kind of what's happening in the world is, again, this is not an ego exercise, but I do want to talk about the credibility that myself, my colleagues, and our group has, and what we've gotten right as clinicians, as experts on the ground, with a very close upfront study from patients and papers. You know, we've done nothing but spend a year obsessively studying this disease, not only from publications, but also from our clinical experience. And I just want to call attention and remind everyone that, you know, it was our group that first called attention to the critical need for corticosteroids, right? It's now standard of care. We've also long advocated for higher dose and long duration for the treatment of what's called secondary organizing pneumonia, which is really what happens after that macrophage infiltration. It damages the lung, and it's an organizing pneumonia which needs steroids. We've long championed the need for anticoagulation. I'll talk about that. And we early were identifiers of the fact that this is an airborne transmitted disease, and it was critical of the types of masks and in what situations. And then our multiple combination therapy protocol, which is a key for this disease. It's so complex. It needs combination therapy. And our protocols from the beginning have relied on that. And I got to tell you, Paul Marek really was our leader in formulating this approach. And we stand by it then, and we stand by it now. It's done nothing but become further validated. And then as many of your audience knows, King Bean, is that we identified ivermectin very early on when we started to see the trials line up. And I'm going to talk about that story and how we identified that this was a really potently effective disease. And ever since that time, the evidence has done nothing but make that determination stronger. So here we are, April 2020, right? My colleague, part of the FLCCC, Dr. Umberto Maduri, he's one of the world experts in corticosteroids and lung disease. He had already done a paper with five other very prominent intensivists around the world. They examined all of the data from SARS, MERS, and H1N1. And contrary to all of the public health agencies around the world, they actually found that if you look carefully at that data, all of those observational control trials, when you control for severity of illness and dose and duration, it showed that corticosteroids were life-saving. He published that in April. The Society of Critical Care Medicine blasted it out to all of its members. Guess what happened? Nothing. Crickets. Nobody paid attention because all of the leading public health authorities said do not use. I knew not only from that, but from talking to people around the world. We talked to people in Italy and in New York and in Detroit and in Seattle. Well, that's not so much Seattle, but Detroit and New York and Italy. We knew that steroids were critical. I was first invited to testify in the Senate back in May. not about ivermectin, but I testified that steroids were critical. And I did that at a time where Australia, the WHO, the Department of Defense, and the NIH all said, do not use. After I got out of that hearing, I underwent weeks of ridicule and criticism and accusations that I were harming people because I called attention to the fact that corticosteroids were critical. And then 6 weeks later, I was apparently validated when the Oxford trial came out and said, thou shalt use corticosteroids. And so then everybody listened, but they wouldn't listen to me before. So our clinical expertise, our decades of treating diseases that were similar, our recognition that this disease absolutely needed corticosteroids in moderate to late phase disease was largely ridiculed. But now it's a standard of care. Just putting it out there, guys. The other thing is, in April, I already started to write a paper with one of the top chest radiologists in the world, Jeff Caney, that this is actually early pulmonary phase. COVID-19 is actually an organizing pneumonia. It's a type of lung injury. It's not infectious, even though it's called a pneumonia. And the standard and primary first-line therapy is steroids. But the thing about organizing pneumonia, in severe and fulminant cases, you need to pulse them. You need high doses. That's been known for decades in fulminant cases. The other thing is you need to continue it along with the disease. Nobody's built on a calendar where, you know, 6 milligrams of dexamethasone for 10 milligrams a day, for 10 days it's just ridiculous. You know, you need to titrate, you need to doctor. And that's what we've been trying to advocate to the world ever since. And very few people are listening. But this took me 6 journals to publish. It's published. And now I'm getting people all the time who text me, hey, great paper. We're seeing a lot of organized pneumonia. What should we do? And I've been trying to tell them what to do since back in the spring. The other thing is this 6 milligrams of dexamethasone. And let me just be clear here. We're a year plus into this pandemic. A year later, and the gods of science and knowledge in all of these public health agencies are still saying remdesivir and 6 milligrams of dexamethasone. I mean, they're not paying attention. If you look at the studies and all the studies that came out since then, anytime you look at methylprednisolone and you look at the number needed to treat to save a life, it's far more impactful than those that use dexamethasone. Higher doses and methylpred lead to much, much greater benefits. And the best benefits are the 250 milligrams for the first 3 days in the ICU. And you see that for every 3 patients you treat, 1 life will be saved. And then more recently, in head-to-head studies, methylprednisolone versus dexamethasone, for every 5 patients you treat with methylpred instead of dexamethasone, you will save a life in this study and 10 for every 10 in this study. So I'm telling you, we are under-treating patients on a global scale, and it's really hard to watch. We are using anemic doses of a corticosteroid that doesn't work very well. And it's not clear to me when the gods of science and knowledge are going to decree that thou shalt use higher doses and for longer durations. But it's really troubling to watch the level of doctoring that's occurring globally. And just keep in mind, we put this thing together back in March. There is such a thing that's called expertise. Everybody wants to scream about evidence-based medicine. What about expertise-based medicine? What happens when you live in an ICU for decades? And you learn through trial and error and through sifting through evidence that some things work better than others. And you know times when things need higher dose steroids. We have been advocating for higher dose steroids for over a year and no one's listening. And this is back from back in April last year. Anticoagulation, that was not a complicated problem to solve. We could see in our exams of the coagulation indices that they were clotting. They were clotting at incredibly high rates. They were off the charts. They needed to be anticoagulated. Yet everybody screamed, you can't anticoagulate without a randomized controlled trial. It's called doctoring. waiting for a randomized controlled trial. I don't even know what to call that is. I don't even know what that name of that is. But doctoring is where you use your clinical judgment, you use your clinical experience, you use your clinical investigations, and you make the best choice possible for the patient before you. And we have been claiming from the beginning, my first week in the ICU, that they should be started up front with anticoagulation. And I'll tell you, even though I got attacked at my institution and they overruled our protocols, months later, again, like steroids, our initial approach is now the standard of care worldwide. It's called doctoring. My case and the troubles I had as a chief of critical care service at the University of Wisconsin was detailed in New York Times Magazine article. And in fact, when the journalist asked the New England Journal of Medicine editor, you know, what he thought about the fact that I got a few things right, he basically said, oh, they got lucky. Yeah, like we need a randomized controlled trial to figure everything out all the time. It's ludicrous. Now, the other thing that we got right is that me and another one of my mentors, we noticed that everybody was getting sick, even with standard masks. If you had close contact with patients in poorly ventilated areas, super spreader events were happening. Anywhere where people were singing in close quarters, you had these massive transmissions. We knew it was airborne. And I wrote an op-ed back in May. It was accepted by the New York Times. The problem is the op-ed board got fired for a different reason, the Tom Cotton editorial, and they dropped my op-ed. I then published it later on in the USA Today. But a group of scientists from around the world, 273 airborne transmission scientists, wrote to the WHO saying, you need to declare that this is airborne spread so the world can protect itself. And they have not yet done that since a year later. I wrote this in July. You can see this was published with me and one of my other mentors. We published an editorial in the USA Today saying that this was airborne transmission and that N95 masks were needed in several circumstances. Look at this. Four weeks ago, an article came out basically talking about all these scientists who are still trying to convince the WHO that this is airborne transmission and they won't do it. I can tell you later why I think they won't do it. It's not about the science. But to try to convince the WHO to call airborne transmission in the pandemic that cratered the world, it's absurd. Just like this person says right here, Dr. Jimenez, it's just absurd. So that's our kind of our track record. And then in October, as we did what we do, which is we follow all the evidence, we're following all of the medicines, all of the trials coming out, Professor Marek, he started to talk to us. Hey, you know, I'm starting to see something around this ivermectin. There's a few trials. They're quite impressive. This is very intriguing, you know, and it was really a departure from all of the other therapeutics we were watching. Like, you know, tocilizumab was very uneven, very conflicting. Everything else was failing. Convalescent plasma, remdesivir is a joke. Nothing was really consistently positive, but ivermectin, when the clinical trials started coming out, they were reproducibly and consistently positive. So I jumped in right behind Paul and I started to research with him. We started to compile all the trials and we put together a preprint in early November. By December, I was asked again to come back to the Senate. The senator had remembered that I had testified for the critical need for steroids and I'd been right in May. And many doctors had reached out to the Senate saying that they'd help them to treat their patients better. He asked me again to testify on our recent expertise. And I testified on the critical need for ivermectin. Apparently, that testimony went viral and it ignited interest worldwide. And more importantly is that we got an audience with the NIH, we pled our case, and they changed their recommendation. Now, although they changed it, they did not go far enough. And I have to tell you, it was really disappointing that they did not come up with at least a weak or cautious recommendation for one of the safest medicines known to man in a pandemic on a risk-benefit analysis. The idea that they only came up with a neutral recommendation is really, for me, one of the historic missed opportunities in this pandemic. If you look at the evidence base now, I love going to this website. They just keep tabulating all the trials. Every time a trial comes out, they put it on the list. They look at the effects. They they summarize the effects. And if you look, it works in prevention. It works early. It works late. It saves lives. And there are over 24 randomized controlled trials, gold standard randomized controlled trials. This evidence base, I've never heard of a medicine sitting on top of as formidable an evidence base as ivermectin sits without a worldwide recommendation. It is absolutely unconscionable what's happening with ivermectin. And if you look, just look at the prevention trials. As of today, if you look at all of them, taking it regularly, you can protect yourself from COVID. On average, on all of the protocols, it's an 85% protection rate. But if you look at these where you take it every week, it's nearly perfect. If you take it weekly, you don't get sick. And so it's incredible its prevention properties. If you look at mortality, there's not a lot of medicines that reduce mortality rates by the minimum of 68% in late treatment and 80% in early treatment. So like any other disease, the quicker you treat, the more lives you will save. Trial after trial after trial. It's very rare that you study a medicine with a dozen or more trials, and you see all of the treatment effects lining up on one side of the null, right? So this is all positive treatment effects, all on the same side. I mean, it's I never see this. The more trials you do, the more likelihood you're going to have some conflicting results. And this is truly remarkable. It's almost a beautiful sight, I find. And yet it gets attacked everywhere. The trials are small. They're poorly designed. They didn't follow. They tested with doxycycline. You just hear nothing but insane arguments trying to argue against this truth. It's right there in the eye of the beholder. I got to tell you, I don't want to talk about this anymore. It's proven independent. I want to emphasize independent expert panels, including my group in the US that just published last week, as well as a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Satoshi Imura, Professor Imura, and his group in Japan. They also did a review. They concluded the same. The UK, the Bird Group, an international consortium of 65 different practitioners and experts, a group in Spain and a group in Italy, independent groups throughout the world are concluding the same, is that it is a proven therapy and it should be adopted worldwide. Beyond the trials evidence, if anyone's ever seen a lecture I've given, I share these analyses all over the place. To me, the model for the world has already been established, and that is the country of Mexico. If everybody did what Mexico did back in December, we would not have a problem with COVID anymore. And what Mexico did is their entire state outpatient health system employed what's called a test and treat strategy. Every testing center, they used rapid tests. If you tested positive, you got ivermectin. So you were immediately treated. You were treated early before you could get sick or deteriorate. And guess what happened? At a height of hospitalizations, at a height of deaths, they watched a precipitous decline in the amount of people dying, the amount of people getting in the hospital, despite an increase in Google mobility tracking indices. So they didn't have to lock down. They treated with everyone with ivermectin. And look what's happening. The best measure to see if you have an out of control pandemic is measuring excess deaths. They had 280% increase in excess deaths in their population back in January, February. After they started their test and treat strategy, now their excess deaths are approaching baseline variation pre-pandemic. They have solved COVID in the country of Mexico, yet exactly no one is paying attention. If you look at occupancy levels in the hospitals throughout Mexico, they have empty hospitals. Look, less than 30% of the hospital beds are full. They have empty hospitals. where in December and January, they had overflowing hospitals. Now they're empty, a sea of green. The only areas where you see that high occupancy are areas where they have very few beds and facilities. And so you can see that playing out in a number of other countries. Look at the shaded area. Again, after they had adopted nationally as an early treatment, you see the excess deaths absolutely plummet despite Google mobility indices going up. That was Panama, Mexico, and then you have Eastern Europe. They went rogue. They broke away from the rest of Western Europe, who says you cannot use ivermectin, right? Slovakia, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, they all adopted it, and look what happened. From the moment they adopted, they noticed that death rates amongst the population precipitously declined. Czech Republic, same thing. And you're seeing this roll out across the world, and just in the past week, we can color in India. All of India now, they're recommending for early treatment ivermectin, right? So I put India here, but this is in the last few months. And I got to tell you, our organization is very proud because we've assisted and guided many of these countries, and they've cited our work in their adoption of this medicine worldwide. And we hope this continues. And this is the most recent from the All India Institute of Medical Sciences in Delhi, as well as the Indian Council of Medical Research. And we trust and we hope that we were going to see a rapid decline in hospitalizations and deaths in India as doctors adopt this widely. Now, let's change gears. Why, if all of those countries are crushing and turning back this tide of COVID and deaths, why, when you look at this map, why is it all gray in North America and in Western Europe? Why are they not adopting ivermectin, right? So why is the European Medicines Agency, the NIH, SAHPRA in South Africa and in Canada, they all say the same thing. The evidence is insufficient and it's unproven. Well, I'm going to tell you, this is what I've studied for the year. Again, this is stuff I didn't know a year ago. I wouldn't have believed it a year ago. I would have listened and I would have said, yeah, maybe that's the case. I don't know. But I've been upfront. I've had a front row seat to what's happened to the evidence behind ivermectin. And this is my interpretation of what's going on. And I'm going to say that there's two things that ivermectin is up against. Number one, it's the modern sort of permutation of what I will define for you as big science. And I'll explain what big science means in a second. And that's what I thought we were fighting for the last month. I've been trying to argue that big science is perverted, it's distorted, it strayed from its founding principles of evidence-based medicine, and we need to fix it. But you know what? Now, I don't think that's the main barrier. It's not about big science. It's actually about the fact that there is a multitude of interests working against ivermectin. There's an opposition to ivermectin being adopted. And I'm going to explain to you why I think that opposition is there and why they're working in the way that they're working. So just hear me out. Number one, this has been bothering me for a decade in medicine, which is that every time I find something that I believe works, or I look at data and I sift through observational trials and I say, hey, we should try this or we should do this, I'm surrounded by colleagues telling me, you need a randomized controlled trial before you can do it. And it better be a big one. And they talk about these big RCTs, a proper RCT, in order to prove something before you can do something. So that totally departs from the history of medicine. And so it's this system, and this is how I put it together, is that it's a system that absolutely demands what's called a big RCT. The problem with the big RCT is very few people can do big RCTs. You need big money for big RCTs. You need big pharma for big RCTs, or you need a big governmental agency like an academic medical center for a big RCT, which is very closely aligned with big pharma. And so if you need a big RCT, you're going to need a big financial interest. And if only big RCTs and big financial interest can get into big journals, and only big journal publications are accepted by big public health agencies, well, guess what you have? You have a system that is completely vulnerable to financial interest. We are living in a health system where there's just no pathway for cheap, repurposed, highly effective drugs to make their way. As you try to navigate through this forest, you get knocked down. Your little trials are dismissed. They're small. They're poorly done. They're not well designed. and they're dismissed as insufficient evidence and unproven. And if you're someone who knows they work and you're seeing it work in your patients, you've looked through the data, you're an expert at the data, and you try to share your expertise, guess what? You're labeled as a medical misinformationist, and you're trying to propagate therapies that are unproven with insufficient evidence. And when you try to do that, you get shut down by big media and big social media. Do you guys get what I mean by big science now? Big RCTs, big pharma, big academic medical centers, big public health agencies, big media, and big social media. You try to get around the big buys with little studies, even if you have over 24 studies repeatedly showing massive effects, it won't work. They will dismiss it. And in ivermectin's case, it's particularly egregious because there's a second reason why they need to make sure that ivermectin does not become the standard of care. And I'm going to talk about that in a second, but I got to tell you, it leaves repurposed, cheap, widely available drugs at a distinct disadvantage, and it hurts us as a population, and it hurts public health. Let's just take an example, right? So COVID broke out, and the U.S. active program, so the government decided to respond in an aggressive manner. We need to do trials. We need to figure out what works. Let's create a public-private partnership. Let's get everybody at the table, all of our governmental agencies. And you guess who they invited? They invited like 20 pharmaceutical companies, and they even invited nonprofits, which are actually kind of proxies for pharmaceutical companies, and I'll explain why in a few. But if you look at the outcome of this quote-unquote public-private partnership, follow along, people, what happened in the first round of trials? Active one, pharma, pharma, pharma. Active two, pharma, 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 pharma. Active three, pharma, 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 pharma. By the way, none of these have worked, right? You guys can tell, but they keep trying to get these patentable and profit-making medicines through. And active four, finally, they do antithrombotics, right? Well, there actually doesn't have to be a competing molecule here, but they actually did do an antithrombotic. And then active five, back to pharmaceutical drugs. And then associated trials with Veklury, your friend and mine, remdesivir. And so finally, in the last few weeks, after a year of people screaming, why aren't you looking at repurposed drugs? Active has finally come around to selecting drugs that are repurposed, widely available, known safety profiles, low cost, and they're going to test them now. Over a year later. Do you guys see the system in action that we're talking about? It takes over a year to test famotidine and celecoxib. And as far as I know, it's not a given that ivermectin is even in this. Now, I really don't care because I got to tell you, ethically, I don't think it's ethical to do a randomized controlled trial with placebo on ivermectin. But apparently the world keeps looking for it. But I don't know, for some reason, they don't seem to be wanting to do it. And I talked about this before about big social media when you don't have proven therapies, but I'll go through that again in a second. So I got to tell you guys, in the last 6 months, I thought we were battling big science and this obsession with these big trials and that you can't prove anything without a big trial. That's nonsense. And I'll tell you why. The principles of evidence-based medicine have long held that the highest form of medical evidence is a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. We now have meta-analyses with over 20 randomized controlled trials with overwhelmingly precise and large magnitude reductions in mortality. You don't need a big RCT. You have a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. No single trial can exceed that. Yet, the entire system, and I would say Western system, still pretends that you do. They are making up the rules as they go along. They are ignoring the rules that have long been established. And I find it unconscionable. So I'm going to tell you guys, and this is where now I'm going off the rails, because this is the only way that myself and my group could come to explain what we're seeing around the evidence for ivermectin, which is they're no longer behaving scientifically. They're not following the rules of science, of interpretation, of meta-analysis of trials. This is not big science. It's actually what's called disinformation. For months now, I thought I was battling this new and more solidified and perverted system of big science, which has all these barriers. But what I've discovered is that it's not about the data. This is no longer a data argument. The data is unassailable. The data is vast. And so I had to start asking myself, why are people not recognizing that ivermectin is like one of the most effective medicines in any disease model in history? And I just, it was driving me nuts. I thought the world had gone mad until I figured it out. And it was actually through the help of some supporters who found, you know, they sent me some articles and I learned about this topic, which is called disinformation. And it was first described by the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is an organization that came together about 50 years ago, a little bit more than 50 years ago, in retaliation against the nuclear armament, armament movement. And what they did is they, more recently, they codified what is what's called the disinformation playbook. And what that is, it's tactics used by corporations who seek to delay government action. It's the way that corporations attack science that is inconvenient to their interests. So when it affects, when the science that's coming out is not good for their income and profit potential, they start to deploy disinformation tactics. And these tactics were first perfected by the tobacco industry over 50 years. And since then, almost every industry and corporation since has borrowed from them. Now, this is not to say that all corporations are evil or that all corporations do this. In fact, it's considered rare. But when it happens, we need to recognize it because it serves contrary to the public interest. And so the five tactics, and they give it these kind of cute names, but you guys will all recognize it, right? So the fake, right? Where they will produce a trial, they'll get scientists to produce data, which actually, you know, neutralizes inconvenient data. So when you have conflicting studies, you can always say the science is uncertain, right? Or they go after the scientists who come out with it. They say they're, you know, they're fraudulent. They do this, or they try to attack their personal histories, or who knows what. Or they say they're not serious, or they're not serious or well trained. And then there's the diversion. And the reason why I have that in red is because that when I saw the diversion, I said, "Aha, that's what's happening with ivermectin." Is that I'm seeing all of these entities and all of these forces, and all of that they're doing is that they're manufacturing uncertainty about the science of ivermectin where little or none exists. And I finally, it was like a light bulb went off. I said, that's exactly why I'm going nuts here, is because nobody's playing fair. This isn't a fair fight. It's not a data fight. It's not that I'm smarter or less smart than them, is that they don't care. And then the other tactics they use is they buy credibility through alliances and or they manipulate government officials. And if you look at through history of corporate disinformation campaigns, many of them occur in pharma. But, you know, let's just skip over the 50, 70 years of the distortion of science around the harms of tobacco, one of the most toxic substances known in the history of public health, right? To asbestos, right? They tried to actually dismiss the harms of asbestos. Merck, around Vioxx, it was causing heart attacks and even deaths. And they tried to dismiss the inconvenient truths of that science. And then most recently, you guys have probably seen the movie, but the scientists that first started to find that the after effects of playing football as a career was leading to these horrific traumatic brain disorders in later life. And the NFL tried to discredit and dismiss those scientists. And so when there's financial interest, some corporations will sometimes, they will actually act out in these really horrific disinformation tactics. And then Avandia is another one, right? The diabetes drug, and then formaldehyde. And then everybody knows that right now in the United States, we have an epidemic of opiate addicts. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. If you guys can remember pre-COVID, some of the horror shows were morgues in these little towns throughout the country were overflowing with overdose deaths. That was a pharmaceutical company that tried to promote a product as being safe when it wasn't. And they did it with the basically alliance with academic institutions. And then obviously even Pfizer has done that with an animal drug that actually caused high arsenic levels. So the list goes on and on. I'm just giving these some of these examples. Now let's talk about WHO. So here's the thing about the WHO is that it has this phenomenal reputation, which is largely well-deserved. At least it was deserved. So when it came about in 1948, it had the highest of principles and the highest of goals. And it had some of the most amazing historic public health advances of all time, right? So they eradicated smallpox in 12 years. They nearly eradicated polio. They led the era of the development of these phenomenal antibiotics, which prevented, you know, deaths from sepsis, the HIV pandemic and TB. They were able to distribute and identify highly effective medicines that were low cost and that could be provided to millions of people around the world to eradicate or at least to mitigate those illnesses. But I got to tell you, and this is really important, that was largely done because it was an organization that has its sole focus on public health achievements. The money was totally unrestricted, and it was basically controlled by public health officers who really were able to establish goals and to achieve those aims. The problem is that was then, and this is now. The money for the WHO is now 70% directed donations. They're given by oftentimes private interest or even nonprofits with specific goals that they want the WHO to achieve. So it's no longer, you know, the independent decisions of public health experts, but they're really under the influence of external interest. And it's because of these directed donations. And so in the more recent years, cracks have started to come out in the WHO, and it has been under relentless attack for at least two decades, if not more, as they've noticed, independent observers have noticed that corporate funders began to influence their specific and declared interests. Funders started to dictate what their goals are in national clinical research, their tech bio interventions that were in their interest, and they even were managing news and media management. And then a revolving door, right? So if you got a plum job or consultancy at the WHO, you could go on to senior positions in government or pharmaceutical industry and vice versa. And you always had this close network of contacts, and there was a very lucrative career opportunities for many people as they passed through these different spheres of public health. And so it appears to be a quite a compromised organization in more recent times, in a marked departure from its history. And that's been well documented. So if you look at how it's been under the influence of the nuclear industry, the accidents at Chernobyl and Fukushima, those reports were largely dismissed and distorted. The true radiation impacts of those accidents have been attempted to be suppressed. And there's clear documentation of that. The most disturbing is the H1N1 in 2009. In the middle of that season, the WHO changed the definition of what it means to be a pandemic. And there's multitudes of evidence to show that the vaccine industry pressured them in order to sell more vaccines. There are numerous allegations of that and lots of evidence to support what happened. And so that's the first example of a global vaccine catastrophe. And then obviously tobacco and then Ebola seemed to be that they were under an influence of political influences and which made them reluctant to call a true emergency. And so they're clearly vulnerable to external influences. beyond governments and beyond pharma, even purported nonprofits also have inordinate amount of influence. And in particular, a lot of attention has been drawn to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They are the second biggest funder of the WHO. They've given $4 billion in the last 20 plus years, and they completely operate the ACT Accelerator Program and Unitaid, which actually has control over the ivermectin research. And so, But not only that, but there a whistleblower came out months ago saying that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation sought to get sovereign nation status at the WHO. They wanted equal voting power as a sovereign nation of the world. One organization, essentially maybe one man being given the influence of a sovereign nation, which is it's just appalling to actually contemplate that. But that's the kind of stuff that's happening, and that's how vulnerable they are. And the overwhelming influence is increasingly described. Again, this was an investigative reporter in the New Republic about a month ago, who really trailed and showed this network of influence, the vast amount of money that the foundation of Bill Gates and Melinda Gates has, and that they essentially are dictating the global vaccination policy. They have funded Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, a large part of which is vaccines, and COVAX, which is a partnership of all of them. And so it's essentially, you know, one of the biggest influencers are the Bill and Melinda Gates. And the other problem is one of their essentially guiding principles is that the intellectual property rights of vaccine manufacturers needs to be preserved even in a pandemic. And you're hearing that in the papers now. People are questioning, why would you do this when the world is in crisis and you're trying to preserve the ability for these vaccine manufacturers to make maximal profits? Why can't you share those intellectual property rights so all of those low and middle income countries can make it and we can get out of this? They don't want to do that. And it's egregious and unconscionable in a pandemic. And if you look on April 22nd on the Gavi website, look, this article appears. Lo and behold, out of nowhere, silence comes noise. Why a potential COVID treatment isn't recommended for use. I mean, I showed you the evidence. I showed you how many independent panels think it should be deployed immediately. Yet Gavi, oddly, and I don't know why, they seem to think that it shouldn't be deployed. And then if you look at the influences further, so this is the team lead, the clinical team that dictates the therapies for COVID. And if you look at the LinkedIn page, he shows up. If you refresh the page, Melinda Gates shows up. They seem to be tightly linked. And so you show that all of these influences are just endemic and intrinsic. And let's talk now about the WHO, because if you look at this document, this is a living guideline, and it was published on March 31st. And I got to tell you that finally, this is where I had my aha moment, because while I was watching the European agencies and Netherlands and Belgium and the crazy Canadians who've lost their way and the U.S. and their dismissals of ivermectin, they never gave you a lot of evidence what they were doing. They just sort of gave you opinions. But what happened here is in this document, you can see plain as day what they did to the evidence base of ivermectin. And let me just take you through that. But it's crazy, this massive evidence base that they were sitting on. There were so many irregularities and so many bizarre actions that they took. It's obvious. All you have to do is read the document carefully. But number one, just look at the membership. They have the chair of guidance support, also a member on the methods committee and the systematic review team. Clearly an irregularity for a guideline review. You don't want someone to have that much influence that would limit or mitigate the objectivity. Further, the most crazy one is they don't have a protocol for what they will consider and won't, which means it allows them to throw out or keep whatever they want, whatever sees fit. And the most dramatic is that the Unitaid search protocol, which is to look for all randomized control trials they could, Unitaid came back from the hunt with a ton of trials, and the WHO proceeded to throw a bunch out. They threw out quasi-randomized. They threw out ones where they didn't have a placebo control, even if it was against oxycycline, which hasn't been shown to work. They threw out, even if it showed to be superior to hydroxychloroquine, they just kept throwing it out and throwing it out. We don't even know how many trials they had when they threw out at least up to 7 at the time of their recommendation. And then they also threw out all trials that investigated ivermectin in the prevention of COVID-19. Does anyone know why they would throw out trials investigating ivermectin in the prevention of COVID-19? I know you know, I know I know, but they basically just say we did not include it. They don't even give it a rationale. I mean, it's not subtle, guys. And then obviously, they don't want to hear anything about observational control trials, which is a shame because when you look at the observational control trials, they are totally consistent with the randomized control trials. 50 to 500 patients, same thing, repeated large reductions in important clinical outcomes. The other thing is we know for a fact that the epidemiologic studies showing ivermectin distribution leading to massive decreases in case counts was presented to the WHO group. Nowhere in that document can you find a mention that they were presented or they considered that data. And then when you look at harm, they somehow, they whittled it down to just 3 trials, which showed a suggestion that it might be harmful. And they said, you know, this looks harmful. And so what I would like to say is, if you read that document, ask yourself as you begin reading the top line, was this written by someone whose intent was objective, or was it written by someone whose sole purpose was to reach a conclusion to not recommend? And I got to tell you, do the latter exercise, because when you do it, you'll see it in the first sentence to the last sentence. Everything is negative, 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 negative. It can't work. There's no mechanisms, haven't been defined. Concentrations can't be reached. Trials are small, poorly designed, not clearly balanced. I mean, it's just a litany of complaints against ivermectin. It's absurd. And then the trial that they show as the highest quality or the lowest risk of bias, which is this JAMA study, actually the entire rest of the world thinks it's the worst and most biased study known to man. And so it's not subtle when you look at that document. I actually think that document's actually helpful because it finally proved to me and taught me what I had suspected, which is that they weren't playing fair. And you just got to look at that document. You can see what they did is absurd and non-scientific. And so this is what they were trying. This is their goal, is they needed to make sure that the quality of the trials could be determined to be very low certainty. If it was anything more, whether it be low or moderate, they would have had to have recommended. Corticosteroids worldwide are based on moderate quality of evidence. Instead, by throwing out this trial and that trial and these trials and those trials, they were left with a tiny little pile. They said, oh, this is so small, it's low certainty, so we can't recommend. The other thing is they had to get around 2 other barriers, which is even if you have very low certainty, if there is evidence of a large magnitude of an effect, for instance, on mortality, they would have to upgrade the quality. Yet, because they whittled it down to so few events, they said that this large magnitude effect is such low quality that there's really not a large magnitude of effect. Meanwhile, all the other independent groups have found it. And then most absurd is that, read the document, they clearly say we could find no dose response relationship, and they name 5 different outcomes. But notice, in the outcomes where they could find no dose response relationship, they do not list time to viral clearance. We know from the Unitaid team led by Andy Hill in their public lectures back in January, they were saying that single day versus multi-day were showing profound differences in the impacts on time to viral clearance. They deliberately avoided mention. It's not subtle. It's not subtle. Further, because the quality was so low per their determination, they said it doesn't even need to come to a vote because it's such crap. Why would we vote on crap? And so literally that's what they did. And then most disturbing, you guys may know this, but in France, there's a court case where there's a formal allegation of misconduct against the sponsors of the research team, the Unitaid sponsors. I talked about who sponsors that, right? Who funds that. And they actually wrote the conclusions for the preliminary round analysis. And a formal allegation has been submitted to the University of Liverpool. This is egregious, and it's already been happening in COVID. We've seen external influences on other reports from the WHO. We already know that they are absurdly susceptible for external influences. Let's go over some other disinformation tactics. But before then, here's the last absurdity of the WHO. So they can't seem to recommend ivermectin for COVID. But let's talk about when they recommended ivermectin for scabies and strongyloidiasis. So for scabies, they came to a worldwide recommendation based on 10 randomized controlled trials, 852 patients, even though it wasn't even as good as what it was being compared to, which was permethrin cream. It wasn't even as good as the cream, and yet they came to a worldwide recommendation. For strongyloidiasis, it merited worldwide recommendation, 5 trials, 591 patients. Meanwhile, the BIRD conference, an independent group of researchers back in March, they compiled 21 RCTs, 2,700 patients, and they said it should be the standard of care worldwide. And look at this slide. Let's compare it to tobacco. So tobacco kills about 500,000 people a year. The use of tobacco saves no one, and it's freely available. Tylenol costs about 500 deaths a year. It saves no one, yet it's recommended despite having no trials to support in COVID. For scabies, it might cause a death a year. It saves no one because it's not a deadly disease, yet it's recommended based on 10 RCTs and 800 patients. And ivermectin, it could save 500,000 people a year, yet it still does not recommend despite 21 RCTs and 2,700 patients. Can anyone see anything that doesn't make sense here? Yes, you can. I know you can. How about this glaring double standard? So ivermectin, the data for ivermectin is just not good enough, right? Let's look at remdesivir. This is from Forbes a couple of months ago. They were like, you know, normally it has to meet standards of safety and efficacy. Yet in October, it was given approval by the FDA based on promising data from small trials with about 1,000 participants. Is this a double standard? Can anyone see that ivermectin is up against a barrier that remdesivir wasn't? And can anyone imagine why? If you're listening, I don't have to say it again. I recommend everybody watch this. This is a phenomenal documentary. It's called Trust WHO. I learned a lot of it. A lot of what I'm talking about tonight is informed by that documentary. And I found it truly eye-opening to understand what's happening in a leading international public health agency on planet Earth. And this was the closing scene from the director general. She was asked a very provocative question at a press conference, and she kind of lost it a little bit. She said, you know, for 70% of our budget, I have to go around the world and beg for money. And when they give us the money, it is highly linked to their preferences, what they like, and it may not be the priority of the WHO. And that says it right there in a nutshell, which is that they're heavily under the influence of external funders. So much so that many employees and scientists have left, and they formed what's called the independent WHO in an attempt to run an organization that is free from such influences. And their main mission is to combat the disinformation around the nuclear industry and the mitigation of the harmful effects around those two disasters. Now, what's important is who could be driving all this? Who would have the incentive to decimate or dismiss or distort the science around ivermectin? Well, the list is really long and the scale of the market is incalculable. If you look at every vaccine manufacturer, the sovereign nations of China and Russia and India, who are trying to curry not only billions of dollars in profits, but geopolitical influences. And then the scale is exponentially increasing. You have booster shot markets where we already have evidence that big pharma is salivating because as we pass from a pandemic to an endemic, they can crank up the prices. There's documentation of pharma executives looking forward to that. And the other thing is all of those novel vaccines rest on what's called an EUA. You can't maintain the EUA if there's a proven therapy, and especially if there's a proven alternative with 40-year track history of safety that could work at preventing getting COVID. And so ivermectin's approval with NECAP, a massive industry. And beyond that, all this vaccine hesitancy, if you actually let the common man or woman know that there's an alternative that has a 40-year track record instead of a vaccine that we still don't know the true safety data on, you would actually increase vaccine hesitancy. And there'd be many in public health who don't want that to happen, right? Those who are convinced that a global vaccination policy is a solution, that would be upsetting to them. Again, I'm not sharing my opinions on that policy. I'm just putting out that it would present as a threat, right? And some of the big nonprofits also believe in that policy. I'm going to take a real break. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here.
Okay. All good. I was just here because I can't see what's out there. And so otherwise I'm talking to my lamp again. So
we are here. You are talking to about 600 or 700 people right now, and we are listening.
Thank you. So it's me, my lamp, and 700 people. Yes. Awesome. Thank you. All right. So let me pick up where I was, is that beyond the vaccine manufacturers is that you have numerous competing oral antivirals made by Merck and Pfizer, and even Gilead now has an oral antiviral. And I learned from my colleague, Dr. Bean, recently that Merck's oral antiviral, molnupiravir, actually retains one of the key mechanisms of action against the virus that ivermectin has. And if those of you playing along at home, has a pharmaceutical company ever borrowed a mechanism from an old off-patent drug and repurposed it for a new one to make money? Well, if that's never happened, Merck just came up with a new idea. And so they're basically bringing, ivermectin redux at high potential profits. And so there's a lot of competition. There's long acting antibody products, and there's the monoclonal antibodies, which is a huge market that they're trying to grow. And then your friend and mine, remdesivir. If you saw what happened in Mexico with the drops in hospitalizations and empty hospitals, what happens to the Gilead's remdesivir market? It would disappear. So is anyone feeling me here that ivermectin is not really well liked out there, and that this is why I keep saying hashtag David versus Goliath. David versus Goliath. There are so many entities that want to destroy and make ivermectin disappear, and it's truly remarkable because it's hurting our global health. Now, what are some other tactics? So I showed you how they got to the WHO and all the crazy stuff, which is so planted WHO. Let me just go through some other stuff that I've been seeing as a student and an observer of the world, as an ivermectin expert. I keep seeing crazy stuff. I keep calling crazy stuff. And now I understand why it's crazy. But here, let's go through it. So number one, colleague of ours, Dr. Ahmed El-Ghazar, he has the largest prospective randomized controlled trial of ivermectin in the world from Benha University, one of the top universities in Egypt. He found in a 400-patient treatment trial, massive reduction in hospitalization rates, 1% versus 22%, mortality rates, 2 versus 20%. And then in prevention or prophylaxis arms, 2% if you took it regularly. And guess what, guys? Is that published on the front page of New England Journal of Medicine yesterday? It is not. It is not published. And yet, when you see the attacks on the ivermectin evidence base, they keep complaining that they're not peer-reviewed. Can anyone sense a double standard? He's told me that he submitted to Lancet, Nature, Chest, Respirology, and the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy. Rejected, 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 without even being sent out for peer review in a pandemic, a prospective randomized controlled trial. This is insane. Meanwhile, your friends and mine at JAMA, they feel that they need to publish this randomized control trial, which is attacked from around the world as just being a failed trial. So many things went wrong with this trial that you can't even list them on one page. And this is not just because I don't like the result. It's just because it is what it is. It's a terrible trial that failed. And yet JAMA is very happy to publish it, and it's very happy to support the conclusion, which is the conclusion is that it doesn't work, even though all over the study, it's an underpowered trial, and there's about 10 pieces of evidence. And that's only one problem with the trial. But yet, this is what gets published. This, no, this, yes. This, no, this, yes. Not subtle. So much so that there was an open letter. Finally, someone's waking up. People are fighting back. A doctor's letter, over 100 doctors signing, saying that this is unacceptable and unconscionable that you would publish a study that actually calls into question the efficacy of ivermectin based on this flawed study. And so people are really angry. And when I say people, I mean physicians. And I champion this this effort. And I think we need more activism like this amongst the physicians. Let's contrast with this. So BMJ, remember April 22nd, the Gavi notice? Well, look, this was get published on April 22nd. This is, again, a two-page letter showing 100 reasons why you should not believe any evidence supporting ivermectin. Don't believe it. It's all bad. You can't trust it. It's terrible data. It's this, it's that, and it's the other thing. And this is their conclusion. Look how laughable this is. This is the conclusion. We think it should be done based on trustable evidence, right? So that's weird because I usually like untrustable evidence. They think it should be done without conflicts of interest. I've always championed conflicts of interest. You guys realize I'm being sarcastic. What's funny about that statement is that almost all of the evidence-based of ivermectin are done by clinician investigators, self-funded, self-directed, with no financial incentives. You cannot find an evidence base with less conflicts of interest than ivermectin. Yet these schmucks want to write an article and the BMJ is happy to publish these guys lecturing the world to watch out for conflicts of interest in regards to ivermectin, an off-patent, widely available drug. This is absurd. And then they go on to remind us that we should have proven safety, 40 years, 4 billion doses. We're not sure of the safety of this one. And then they remind us that we should do patient consent and we should do ethical approval before doing the trials. That's weird. I've never heard of that concept. Again, another novel concept. This is a joke, guys. Again, not subtle. When you see this stuff, laugh, call it out. This is absurd and this is disinformation. I'm just pointing it out to you. Beyond the selective bias, look what's happened when we do pass peer review. So our group and Tess Laurie's group from the UK, and might I mention Tess Laurie's group here, right? They have been writing guidelines and doing Cochrane Library reviews and systematic reviews for decades. They're experts at it. They passed peer review and the editors whacked this, retracted it prior to publication. Our group, again, some anonymous external reviewer that the editor, that the publisher called in, also whacked us. Two different review manuscripts concluding that it would work, they get whacked. So much so, other repurposed drugs. So en masse last week, a number of editors at Frontiers in Pharmacology, a completely compromised series of journals, and their head editor really should go. I wouldn't submit anything while he's there. He's clearly shown himself to be under the influence. His name is Fred Fenter. He's the one who retracted our article. But now multiple other editors say, we will not review papers for anymore. We cannot trust in your objective management of scientific manuscripts. And then now it gets really almost stupid funny. So this FDA posting, you guys have seen this, the picture of the horse. So you should not use ivermectin for COVID-19 because of this horse. Wait, I'm trying to figure out, what's the point of the horse? Oh, I know what the point of the horse is. They're telling people don't use animal ivermectin. They provided no specific support for people who got sick. They mentioned that some got sick. Well, from what we heard, there's maybe 4 cases, but no further details. And they also say, don't use it, might be dangerous because it's not FDA approved. We know it's not FDA approved. No pharmaceutical company has sought to apply for FDA approval. And the idea that it might be dangerous after 4 decades and 4 billion doses is laughable. And then the funniest part of this stupid statement is they literally admit in the middle of the statement, the FDA has not reviewed data to support use of ivermectin in COVID-19 patients to treat or to prevent. However, some initial research is underway. So they're telling you don't use it, but we haven't reviewed the data. Please, does anyone find this? To be honest, nothing's funny, but this is so ludicrous that it merits at least a morbid chuckle. And then we're seeing hit jobs in the media. So I did an interview with this AP reporter named Beatrice Dupuis, who stole 25 minutes of my life by interviewing me and my expertise on ivermectin. And I shared with her all of the evidence, all of the trials, and all of the support showing that it's highly effective in prevention and treatment. And this is what she wrote. She basically said that I'm a misinformationist. There's no evidence that it's been proven. And basically, the entire argument of this article is that the NIH has not approved it. And the problem and the reason why I have a resentment, well, many reasons why I have a resentment, but if the point of her article was that the NIH hadn't approved it, so it's not proven, why did she need 25 minutes of my time? She could have just written the article without asking me anything and just said, hey, NIH doesn't approve ivermectin. So that's why I demand 25 minutes of my life back. And then you guys see how the system goes, right? So if NIH doesn't approve, the social media also follows suit. So media, social media, Twitter, your Twitter account will be permanently locked if you keep mentioning ivermectin. Your videos will be taken down and Facebook groups will be taken offline. They do not mess around. Just so you guys know, playing along at home in terms of censorship, right, is discussion of ivermectin harmful? Will it kill people? Does it incite violence, hatred, racism? Is it violent speech or insightful speech? No, it's scientific discussion. It's a deliberation of data. Yet they feel that it's so harmful, it must be suppressed. Have we not read history books? Have we forgotten our history and what this country is built on and our understanding and evolution of what free speech is? This is not where you censor. It's insane. And then now we just discovered today on Newswires, we tried to put out a joint press release with Tess Lowry's group in the UK, trying to help guide and support the Indian health authorities. They're trying to navigate a massive humanitarian crisis. And we put out a joint letter with some recommendations and support. And we were told they will not allow our press release to go because it's company policy. You cannot mention ivermectin. Unreal. And then if you guys remember, Merck, very magnanimous to the world. They wanted to support good medical care through this pandemic. So they put out the statement unauthored with no scientific support for it. And they just said, hey, we don't know why you think it works. We can't find any evidence that it works. And we're not even sure it's safe. Can you guys laugh along with me? We have no evidence why you think it would work. By the way, there's 10 years of antiviral experiments showing efficacy of ivermectin against numerous viruses. And then we don't even have to talk about the clinical activity. But this is just a joke. So Merck does not have our best interests at heart. And then again, the competitors, right? Pfizer has an oral pill. Gilead has an oral pill. Even at the beginning, Satoshi Imura, the Nobel Prize winning discoverer of ivermectin, who worked on this with Merck, the old Merck, not the new Merck. Just like there's an old WHO, there's also an old Merck. Those were the good guys. Those were last century. The new Merck said, no way, we're not going to do any research on ivermectin and COVID. Why would we do that? We can't make a buck. Well, they didn't say that. I'm saying that. And then now you guys, if you're following our social media channels and our organization, I'm actually mired. I'm actually doing work on individual cases where families are distressed because the hospitals and physicians are not following the science and they're appealing to judges. Help a judge. It's a safe medicine. We know it works. There's all this data, and yet the hospitals are blocking us. And so far in the four orders where the patients got the ivermectin as a result of the judges, they've all survived. They've all been discharged. And now this week, we have two other cases where the hospitals lost. So judges are doctoring now. Now, I'm not a proponent of judges doctoring, but when you have a complete failure of the health system that is beholden and completely captured by these external interests, you know, thank God for the law. I'm sorry that we had to resort to the law, but thank God for them. And this is the unfortunate consequences, which is this was written on a Twitter, and it kind of moved me in a not a good way, but, you know, and I totally agree with this gentleman. The problem is that whatever any scientist or expert says, and whatever data they present, nobody believes it any longer. Trust in science has been irrevocably broken. That's what happens when science loses its independence and objectivity, bought by the highest bidder. And keep in mind, we're going to post a white paper, which is largely the basis of this talk that I've been writing for weeks. And I think this should be posted and disseminated as an attempt to counteract the disinformation. And just, this is my last appeal, my last slide. To all the providers of the world, the medical students, the nurse practitioners, the physician assistants, and the attendings, is come on, man. We're a year into this, and we're offering our patients 6 milligrams of dexamethasone and remdesivir. That's a joke. You know, fire the scientists, fire the desk jockeys, get real doctors, get frontline doctors, and go back to doctoring. Come on, man. Don't rely on their reasoning and the gods of science and knowledge behind enemy lines or, you know, in rear guard. You know, we're just not relying on our independent critical analysis. Our patients demand that of us. That's what we're supposed to do. It's our core responsibility as a physician. Do the best you can for your patient using the best available evidence you have. Stop being lazy. Stop relying on this flawed guidance from compromised and essentially captured health agencies. And with that, I'm going to stop. Thank you.